Well, good morning, y'all. We'll go ahead and get started. We'll be in 1 Samuel chapter 17. And we'll cover the famous battle between David and Goliath this morning. Chapter 17 begins with the Philistines gathering their armies together to battle. And so it may be helpful to have a short refresher on the situation with the Philistines. Israel never completely subdued the land of Canaan. Throughout the book of Joshua, you have victorious battles, and you have Israel taking control of the land of Canaan and sort of owning it, but that doesn't mean that they successfully wiped out all resistance fighters. And Judges chapter 1 explains all of the people, all of the tribes of Canaan and the Philistines and the other peoples there who remained a nuisance, and several of them actually got the upper hand and were dominant in their regions. And so the Israelites were not in complete control of the land of Canaan for quite a while. When King Saul first becomes king, he's pretty successful, actually. And the last time we see Saul, prior to the David and Goliath battle, he had continued to be successful. In 1 Samuel chapter 14, it says, verse 47, Saul established his sovereignty over Israel and fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, peoples of Ammon, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he harassed them. And he gathered an army and attacked the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. So Saul had been more or less a successful king and military leader, even up until this point. But what we're seeing now with Goliath is a resurgence of Philistine resistance. And probably Goliath had a big part to do with that. When you have a special champion of your team or your army, then that reinvigorates the people and they start gaining more ground. The fact that Saul is dealing with, we might say, mental and spiritual challenges is also a factor here. You probably would be safe to assume that when he was in the worst of his bouts with the distressing spirit, he was not doing a great job leading, and so that probably also created an opportunity for the Philistines to come back onto the scene. The setting is the Valley of Elah, and it is about 30 miles from Jerusalem in the region of Hebron. Scholars are not completely sure where it is. They have certain suggestions, feel fairly confident that they have the general area. It's told to us here that it's in between Socah and Azekah, but people aren't really sure where either of those towns are, so they have to guess. It's a valley with sort of mountains on either side. Now, these mountains are not like the Rockies. They're not super-duper mountains, but they're tall enough. They are, the whole area of Jerusalem is hill country, really. So this is a valley in between those two hills, and the armies are camped on either side of the valley. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side. Israel stood on a mountain on the other side. The valley is between them. And we know that this was a fairly regular battlefield because it has the name Ephes Damim, which means in Hebrew, the boundary of blood. And so this was a line that divided the territories that was a regular site of violence and warfare. And so Goliath enters the scene. Verse 4. A champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath. His height was 6 cubits in a span. This is traditionally 9 feet tall and a little bit more. 9 feet. I've seen 9 feet 9 inches used quite a bit. And Some scholars think that that's too tall, so they try to get him to be a bit shorter. But in the history of human giantism, just sort of what we know about giantism, 9 foot is well within the range of what we've recorded. In modern history, there have been people who were diagnosed as giants who were 10 feet tall. And so for Goliath to be 9 foot tall is not anything that stretches the bounds of believability. It would be significantly tall, of course. He would be someone that everyone talked about and was famous. But he's not so outrageously tall to make us need to question the accuracy here. 9 foot, over 9 feet tall would be big. It would be really big. And that's why he's noteworthy as a giant. If you look in 1 Chronicles 20, there's a little bit of extra information about Goliath's family. And I think this is the kind of stuff that really is delightful, especially for kids. 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5 through 8, says that all of Goliath's family were giants. And in fact, most of the people in the area of Gath were giants. And it talks about Goliath having a son who has 24 fingers and toes. And so he has six on each hand and foot rather than just five. And the idea is these guys just have more of everything. You know, they're big people. They got more than you have. And so ordinarily, you're going to lose. And of course, David and his men defeat all of these giants. So this is part of Israel's folklore. We believe it's real, of course. But this idea of slaying giants in order to found your country becomes something that everybody has to have. You know, if you read the history of Rome and founding of England and other countries across Europe, they all took their inspiration from this. And so they all have to have a story about how their hero killed all the giants who were originally in the land. And so this story of David fighting the giants is important for the rest of sort of Western literature as well as biblical history. Now there's a good bit of description about what Goliath looks like, what he's wearing, and this is also we will have a picture of a big imposing presence. He has bronze armor. And bronze armor is important because it's more durable than what they would have previously had, but also it's going to reflect the sun. And the ancient people really played up on this idea of when they went out to the battlefield, they wanted to be bright and shining. That would inflict fear in the eyes of their opponents. Also could get in the way of their eyesight. You know, if they're trying to do any sort of distance work and they're seeing bright light everywhere, it's going to distract them. It says that he has a bronze helmet. He's armed with a coat of mail. That's what my Bible English translation says. It's literally scale armor. And so this is not rings of mail, but big scales on top of each other like a reptile. And many commentators point out the parallelism here between Goliath and a serpent. You know, he looks like a bronze serpent. A very large snake man. I don't know that we have to go too far with that because we know scale armor was just a fairly common technological thing back then. It was a way to be durable. But there's probably some imagery there that Goliath represents the seed of the serpent. He is the force of Satan fighting Israel. His coat weighs 5,000 shekels. And, of course, the shekel we think of as a monetary term. And so it's the equivalent weight of 5,000 coins. That's what it's saying. In the ancient world, the weights and measures were not standardized across the whole world. And sometimes they weren't even standardized in regions. So they'd have to use things that were common. Shekels. So this many shekels. And there's not a lot of agreement on how much this would have been because shekels would vary depending on who was making them. And so commentators can't give us a terribly accurate answer to how much this coat weighed, but they estimate it would have been around 200 pounds. So very heavy. For a giant, he could do that, and that's the point, is this is not something ordinary people could wear. bronze armor on his legs. He has a lance strapped to his back. And his spear is especially large. It says that,
verse 7, the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels. And the estimate there is 15 to 16 pounds. And so you can imagine if just the spearhead is 15 to 16 pounds, and it's at the end of a very large wooden shaft, that's very heavy. This is not the kind of thing that ordinary people are expected to be able to use. And so the point here is to show that Goliath is a sort of a superman. He is bigger and stronger, and this is why the Philistines are being successful now. And Goliath knows it, of course. He knows that he is better than anybody else on the field, and so he taunts them. And what's interesting here is that Goliath doesn't want an ordinary military battle. That's not what he's looking for. He wants to settle this battle with a duel between individuals because he knows he has the upper hand. And so the effect of his taunt is to bait someone from Israel to volunteer. To sort of be the representative for Israel so that he could then defeat them and not have to have a normal, typical battle. Pastor Snyder, would you read Goliath's taunt for us? So beginning in verse 8 through verse 10.
Then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together."
All right, thank you. The translation here could actually be rendered, "Am I not the Philistine?" Uses the definite article. And then he calls the people of Israel, of course, the servants of Saul. This is a jab because he's saying that Goliath is not a servant of whoever the Philistine king is. He's the Philistine. He represents all of what Philistia is in himself, and the people of Israel are servants of their king. So he's belittling them, and he's also trying to use a little bit of political manipulation here. If he can get one of them to say, "Well, I'm not just a servant of Saul, I'm as good of a fighter myself," then that'll encourage them to kind of accept this challenge. And he's saying none of them are his equal. And he says, "Find me someone who I can fight, a champion, a man." And the word there is actually something that could be translated as middleman. And this is a word that commentators talk about. It has something of a history in ancient literature. It means, you could translate champion, but it means someone who will represent your people. And whatever he does, your people are considered having done. Whatever happens to him, then your whole people take the fall with him. And so this is sort of a hero's duel, like you would see in the Iliad, if any of y'all haven't read that. The Iliad is a series of sort of mano and mano battles between the superstars, and everyone else watches. And then they stand back and watch. And whoever wins that battle, then that's over. The battle is over. He gets the prize. He takes all their stuff. And then they regroup and start again later. And so Goliath is trying to get them to accept an arrangement like this. And this is probably coming from the fact that the Philistines wouldn't be able to win an ordinary war. You know, they've been on their heels. They've been losing. So this is Goliath's strategy to get Israel to accept his terms, so that he'll have a position of strength over them. And when he says, "I defy the armies of Israel," that word "defy" is literally the word for desecration. I reproach, I desecrate, I contaminate. And this means the religious purity of the land. And Goliath is saying that he is violating their holiness code. The land of Israel is supposed to be a special land, a holy land, a clean land in the sense of the temple and the tabernacle. So Goliath is saying, yes, I defy that. I violate that. I desecrate that. And when you compare David's words in verse 26, you can really see what this means. David spoke to the men and said, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And so David says there's a reproach in the land of Israel. An uncircumcised Philistine is causing this. And so the connection between circumcision and reproach highlights this idea of ritual ceremonial purity. In Joshua, when the people have to all be circumcised at Gilgal, it says that they rolled away the reproach from Israel. So they're being in an uncircumcised state, but about to enter the Holy Land, was a reproach, a defilement. And so that's what Goliath is saying. He's owning it. I am contaminating your purity zone. That's what I'm doing. And I will continue to do this until you find someone to stop me. And so this is not, it is personal boasting, but it's also a religious challenge. This is a religious battle of the competing notions of holiness and religious power. And David, of course, interprets it that way. He says, you're defying the armies of the living God. But what is the reaction of the people of Israel? Do they want to step up and fight? Do they want to do something? No. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. The word for dismayed is literally shattered. They were broken. They fell to pieces and were greatly afraid. And Goliath continues this ritual taunting for 40 days. So nobody from Israel is taking him up on this. And Goliath is continuing to bait them and to taunt them and to really blaspheme against Yahweh. And that is what's happening here. And so that is the setting for David to make his entrance.
Stephen.
Yes.
Would this be not so uncommon to Israel because of federal representation, like of Adam mm-hmm. and of Jesus to come?
That's a great observation. That is definitely connected here. There are people who represent the rest of the group. And so Israel, I'm not sure, at this stage in history what their level of consciousness about that would have been. Throughout the history of the judges, you had, regional folks who did that job. And then with the monarchy, the idea is the king would do it himself. Uh-huh. But of course, this is King Saul, who they may or may not be happy about at this stage in history. But you're right that that's what we should see today when we're reading this story. There's a sense of federal headship, corporate personhood. I don't mean corporations today. I mean one person representing the body. And so that is a very important theme. 1 Corinthians 10 tells us that that was true of Israel with Moses. It says the people were baptized into Moses. So Moses was their representative. So yes, that's what's going on. Goliath is the representative of Philistia.
I was just going to say one more thing about that. How's that compared with today's America? Good or bad, leaving Christianity behind or not, leaving federal headship? Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a difference that's important because the federal head of our country is not the federal head of our covenant with God religiously. So right. there is a distinction there that is different from. So we wouldn't want to say that it's a strict federal headship in the sacred sense, but it could definitely be a political headship, absolutely. Obama is America, especially on the international scene.
Right.
And, I mean, we saw that at the Olympics, you know. He's the one who gets to decide who represents America at the Olympics, and he made a very overtly political statement, absolutely. And so, yeah, that's true in a political sense. When international people think about America, they think about our leading figures, particularly the president. For religious purposes, we want to be careful that we don't allow people to unite those anymore, because our covenant head before God is Jesus, and then politically there are all sorts of different conversations, and we would like our political representatives to be godly and be Christians, but that's still always going to be different than Jesus. And it's a little different than Israel, because in Israel's time, they were uniquely a covenanted nation, whereas in our day, theoretically, you could have lots of Christian nations. I mean, that would be the goal. We don't have to have one Christian nation. So there are some differences, but it is a good lesson that corporate personhood or federal headship is still real. People still notice that, and we're still judged that way. And frankly, I mean, most of America, when they voted for Obama, were happy with that. I mean, that's the challenge that conservatives have to understand, is, I mean, a majority of the country wanted that. So it was close. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it's not 80-20, but, you know, that's the situation. So do you have something else, Paul?
I was just going to say how totally different all this is. And when you read the Homer stuff, like, my first thought would be like, so Goliath beats David, then you go decimate him anyway. You know, like, why would you let anything rest on that? It's because they took that sort of situation seriously.
Absolutely.
Like, you had to accept the outcome of yep. that guy versus David. So.
And this is parallel, it's not exactly the same thing, it's parallel to the trial by ordeal. You know, you say, well, we don't know what the right answer is, so we're going to all agree to this weird little ritual, you know, whether we throw somebody in a vat of boiling water or we arm wrestle or whatever, and, you know, whatever the result is, that solves it. And that was practiced all over the world, you know, until relatively recently. Perhaps in some countries still is. It was eventually done away with in Christian countries, but fairly late, I mean, you know, 13th century, 14th century. And so that's the idea, is that they've agreed to the terms of this, and whoever wins, wins. And so David enters the scene. It tells us a little bit about him. We covered that last week, so we won't repeat that. But his dad sends him to the battlefields to bring food, dried grain, loaves of bread, and cheese. And of course, cheese was always one of the favorite foods for the military, because you can keep it forever. I mean, as long as you've got it wrapped up properly and at the right temperature, put it in a cave, it's just going to get better. So they love cheese. The Romans carried cheese all over the world, of course, but it was true even back in Israel. And David is sent to go bring food, but also to carry back a report of his brother's fare, how they're doing, and to give his dad an update. So David rises early, leaves a sheep with the keeper, and he goes. And it tells us that he's already been working for Saul. Not full-time, necessarily. He's doing some work with Saul, some work with the sheep, but he's already working with Saul. He probably knew what was going on. It's not like he was completely ignorant about the political situation. So he goes to the battlefield to check in, and it says he leaves his supplies in the hands of the supply keeper, ran to the army, came and greeted his brothers. And as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. And he spoke according to the same words. So Goliath had his script, and he said it every day. And David happens to be there while this happens, and he says, hey, we got to do something about this. What are you guys doing here? You're just going to take this? We have to spring into action. The men of Israel fled from him, from Goliath. They were dreadfully afraid. And so they say to David, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich him with great riches, will give him his daughter, and his father's house will be exempt from taxes. So, you know, not a bad plan, you know. We could find a way to reinstitute this sort of policy. No, I'm joking. But it would be, yeah, it's a way to get people to do it. And so David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, what shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine? And it's interesting the order here, because they just told David what will be done, right? And so David isn't asking out of ignorance. This is more similar to getting pumped up. You know, you've seen the football teams before the game, right? They're in the huddle and they're asking all these questions and, you know, who that going to beat them Saints? We know the answer to that. Nobody. But we still ask the question, right? And we ask it again and again because we're getting ready for war. You're chuckling, but it's true. This is not just a normal question. Say again, what now? Now, David knows, and he's basically saying, I'll do it. Tell me about it. Let's go. Let's get going. He's getting worked up. He's ready to fight. He wants to do it. What's going to happen? What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? David knows that this is big picture religious history. This is not just one man trying to be tough against another man. This is the reputation of God on the line here. And the people answered him and said, so shall it be done for the man who kills him. And so this is the setting. David is sort of whipping up the crowd and getting them excited and ready to battle. And he's taking on the responsibility for himself. And then his brother shows up. And it's very interesting here. We think about this chapter as telling the story of the fight between David and Goliath. Actually, that is very, very brief. And there are three sections here where people are not believing David. And so this is just as important as the battle. David's interaction with the skeptics and the naysayers. Eliab is the oldest brother. Take that into account. He should be the leader of the family. He ought to be the one who's taking initiative. And so he hears David assuming the role of champion, and his anger was aroused against David. And he said, why have you come down here? With whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come to see the battle. Now, this is classic passive-aggressive behavior. Eliab has been declining to fight. I mean, he's been here with the army, right? He's not going to fight. And when David shows up and it looks like David wants to fight, Eliab does not support David. Eliab is angry with David. He says, David is proud. Who do you think you are? You're just going to come here and join and start fighting? Shouldn't you be back with the sheep? Don't you have a job to do? I bet those sheep are dying. You just left them without anybody to take care of them. He's accusing David of acting out of line. You know, this is not your place, David. You are younger. You need to stay down. What are you even doing here? And this is not a biblical notion of pride, of humility, and this is sin. Eliab is wrong here. This idea that, well, you know, you can't do it. you're young, you should be a shepherd. What are you even doing here? It's masked in a sense of piety, right? You know, hey, you got to be humble. You got to pay your dues. But really, it's an excuse to keep anything from getting done. Nobody's going to fight. Hey, if I'm not going to fight, I don't want you fighting either. Because, you know, then everybody will see somebody could have fought. There was the 19th century sort of revivalist guy who we would disagree with a lot of his tactics, but Dwight Moody has this great line. I like my way of doing it better than your way of not doing it. And this is super common, especially in churches and amongst religious people. You sort of say, well, who could do such a thing? It's so hard. You know, the rules are what they are. You know, you're going to mess it up. So let's just don't do it. Just nobody do it.
One point here to make is that this is after you have seen David anointed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Oh, yeah. So in a sense, he's going against what God has said. Right?
Absolutely.
Through oil poured on his brother's head. Right?
Oh, yeah.
So God has picked him out and said, you're going to be in charge. And now he's fighting that.
Yeah.
And more so than any like cultural, you know, requirements.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so he is, he does not want David to assume his position. And he's actually trying to guilt David into not doing what David is supposed to do, to keep David from following what he is called to do. And I think this is an important lesson here, that David would have been, at this stage of his life, it would have been a little bit dicey for him to say, yeah, I'll be your hero, I'll be the champion, I will lead the armies. It would have. I mean, God's calling him to do something that is challenging, and it is a little bit extraordinary. And so people would have said, no, you can't do that. And there would have been a way in which they could have made an argument that David is, you know, David's out of line. David's wrong. But David being confident at this stage isn't pride in the sinful sense. And this is really important for us to understand, that there is a godly ambition that means that you are going to do what you feel God has called you to do, and you believe God is going to bless that. There is actually a book, Doug Wilson recommended to me about a year ago, and it's called Recovering Ambition. And the book, it actually makes this point that conservative Christian churches have tricked themselves into not allowing people to be ambitious. You know, they say, don't be prideful, don't think you're going to do it, stay there, wait. And that has a sliver of truth in it, of course. You have to wait for the Lord, you have to be humble. But if you turn that into a straitjacket to prevent people from stepping up and taking responsibility, you've completely misused the whole point. And so for a young man to be ambitious is not sinful. It depends on why he's ambitious and what he does with his aspirations and goals. The ungodly, sinful pride is Nebuchadnezzar saying, look at this great city which I have made with the strength of my hands. That's sin. But when you say, you know, I think God has called me to this, and I think he's going to carry through with his promise, so let's do it. That's not sin.
That came into play when we were electing officers, when, the scripture says in 1 Timothy, he who desires the office of an elder or a bishop desires a noble task.
Yep.
And there was a little bit of, you know, somebody said, well, I think God may be calling me to be an elder. The people said, well, wait, who are you?
That's right. You know? It's a common problem, especially among sort of strict-minded religious believers. You know, they want to do what's right and following procedure, but you have to be careful here. You have to know the spirit of the law, not just the letter. You have to say, what is causing this person to want this? And be excited, being motivated, being confident, those are good. Those are strengths. You want to see that in someone. And so that's what David's doing. I'll do it. I'll fight the giant. I mean, seriously, David is probably 17 years old, 18 years old. These other guys are in their 20s to 30s, and he wants to fight a giant. And he wants the outcome of that fight to be impacting the rest of the people. It's a big deal. He wants to do it because he feels God has selected him to do it. Eliab is standing in the way. And it's really hard to respond to a charge. Hey, you're acting out of line. You think you're better than everybody else. Because you say, nuh-uh. Well, then you just confirm it, right? Hey, see, he's arguing with me. So David, he just says, what have I done? Is there not a cause? That's his answer. Hey, I mean, what do you expect? What do you want me to do? Look at the situation. And so he turns. He leaves Eliab. He doesn't, you know, try to stay and settle the matter with Eliab. He turns to other people and continues to do what he was doing. Hey, what's going on? Who's going to fight this guy? What can we do? I'll do it. And when the words which David spoke were heard, they were reported to Saul, the king, who sent for him. And so David goes to Saul, and he says to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him, probably because of Goliath. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. So David himself is volunteering. He's saying, I will do it. Let me at him. And Saul's reaction is a little bit similar to Eliab, but not the same, right? I mean, Saul's like, well, I don't know. You're not quite ready, are you? Can this happen? You're not able to go against this Philistine, for you are a youth, and he is a man of war from his youth. So there's a genuine question here. Saul's like, I don't know, but he doesn't rebuke David. You can see the difference already. And so David gives his answer, and he appeals to his work history. You know, he says, well, I haven't done exactly this, but I've done things that are comparable to this, and I've seen the Lord blessing me in those activities. And so he explains, which again we mentioned last week, his experience fighting lions and bears. And he doesn't hit them with slingshots. He doesn't hit them from a distance. He wrestles them hand-to-hand combat, grabs them by their beard, strikes them, and kills them. Now, in his explanation of this, David says, it was the Lord who delivered me. The Lord delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear. He will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. So this tells us David's confidence is not in himself, even though he can say, I've done it a little bit before. I have a work history. But he still says, God worked in those events. God blessed me. God defended me then. And he will deliver me in the future. And Saul actually responds appropriately to this. We have to be real careful with Saul. We're sometimes eager to just make him the bad guy. Saul is, he's good and bad on and off again throughout the whole story. And so Saul says, go and the Lord be with you. Which means, you know, Godspeed. May the Lord protect you and carry this out and protect you. Now, Saul does attempt to help David, right? The famous story of Saul's armor. And this is good, actually. We don't need to read in too much here that Saul is, you know, still trying to stand in David's way. I mean, this is what you would have done normally. You would try to give the person your best armor. So he gives him the bronze helmet, the coat of mail, a sword, but David refuses them. He says, I cannot walk with these, for I have not tested them. This need not mean that David was not strong enough to operate them. That's one way people read it. But remember, David was described already as being a mighty man of war when people pointed to him and said, this guy's a mighty man. So it doesn't mean that he's not strong enough. It just means he's not comfortable in them, right? They're not his armor. You have to get used to things like this. And so he says, I don't want to do that. I'm not going to use your armor to fight this battle. I'm going to do it without that. Now, of course, he's confident God's going to make it work. So this isn't just saying, I don't like the armor. I mean, he's saying, I know God's the one who's going to make the difference here. Now, again, Saul, he could have taken this as an insult. It would have been real easy. The guy says, no, I don't want your stuff. I'm doing it my way. And it doesn't tell us how he responded, how Saul responded, but he lets David go. He says, yeah. And after this, he loves David for a while. So Saul is still not anti-David. And so David takes his staff in his hand. He gets the 5 stones from the brook. Lots of you know, interpretations and explanations about what the five stones mean. I'm just going to be conservative and say that they're five stones. And he was going to use them for battle. He didn't need all five, but he took them. And so he goes to meet Goliath. And Goliath curses him. It says, Paul, do you have your Bible handy? Read in chapter 17, verse 42 through 44.
And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field."
All right. So Goliath continuing his taunting. And so we do see an arrogance in Goliath, absolutely. You coming to me with just, you know, little bitty things, stones, sticks, you know, my dog, what are you going to do? You're not going to be able to handle me. And he says, "I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field," which means I'm going to kill you and leave your body right here. In the ancient world, to be eaten by birds and beasts was a curse. It meant that you're experiencing eternal punishment. And this is why burial was so important in Israel, to protect the body. This is actually a point of parallel with the ancient Greeks. They felt the same way. They wanted the body to be buried, and if it wasn't, they thought you were trapped in some limbo land. That happens all the time in the mythology. Israel values bodies even after they die, which is one reason Christians have resisted cremation. You know, that's a little bit controversial these days and not a hill I would die on. But, you know, when people ask, this is still the answer. To desecrate the body after death is a symbol of condemnation, even into the afterlife. And so that's what Goliath is saying here. I'm going to kill you and I'm going to let birds and beasts eat your body up. That's what's going to happen. And so he's cursing him, and this has religious overtones. My God's going to be your God. The religion of the Philistines is going to prove triumphant. And then David gives his response. And, you know, David, you just get the sense that this guy, he was good with words. I mean, he was an inspiration. He was a great talker. And he is in command of his soldier personality. Ronnie, will you read verse 45 through 47? Some of my favorite lines in all of Scripture.
Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands."
All right. David is confident, and he is willing to talk the talk, and he knows that God is going to walk the walk. This is similar to Elijah when he curses the prophets of Baal. Again, don't fall into the trap that Christianity is all about niceness. We ought to be more or less nice most of the time, but when it's time to battle, it's time to battle, okay? There's nothing in the Bible that says you can't be a man. And so David is talking strong here, and he says, "I will take your head from you." One way up there, the real tall head. That one's coming off. And I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistine, so not just your carcass, all your people's carcasses, to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth. Why? So that all the earth shall know that there is a God in Israel. And then the assembly, and he means at this point the people of Israel, will know that the Lord does not save with the sword and the spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. And so David knows that God is controlling this. God is the real power here. And in the Old Testament, whenever Israel is experiencing victories, it's always explained this way: God did it. The the general of the army of hosts, you know, the angel of the Lord, the tabernacle. The battle is the Lord's. And so David fights confidently, but all by himself with sling and stones. And when Goliath hears it, he goes out to fight. And again, the battle is very short, verses 48 through 51. That's all the actual action. David puts his hand in the bag, took out a stone, and slung it. Struck the Philistine in the forehead. And this description, a little bit graphic, but you know, your young boys will enjoy it. The stone sank into his forehead. And he fell on his face to the earth. So he doesn't fall backwards. All your children's Bibles are wrong when they have those pictures of Goliath on his back. He probably stumbled a bit. He falls forwards. This parallels Dagon, when the Ark of the Covenant is placed before Dagon and he falls forward. And the first time he falls forward and they set him back up. The second time Dagon falls forward, what happens? His head comes off. So there's a direct parallel here. Goliath falls forward. And it actually says, and he died when he falls forward. He struck the Philistine and killed him. He fell on his face and he died. But then David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. So David is correct. The Lord doesn't save by the sword. He didn't use a sword. He only had a sling and a stone. That's all he had with him. But he takes Goliath's sword. He drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head. So he keeps his promise to behead Goliath, but he uses Goliath's sword to do it. And he takes Goliath's head home with him. I don't know if y'all knew that, but he takes it to Jerusalem. And the Jewish tradition is that he buried it. And in Jerusalem, and the place of the burial, which this is to me fascinating, Golgotha, the hill of the skull. And Golgotha is an abbreviation, Goliath of Gath. So when Jesus is crucified at the place of the skull, that's where the head of Goliath was said to have been buried. So talk about the seed of the woman crushing the head of the seed of the serpent. David takes the armor and sword home with him as well as a trophy. And what's interesting here is that the sword eventually makes its way to the tabernacle at Nob. And we'll get to this later in our series. But in chapter 21, David is on the run. He ends up with the priest of Nob before an altar. And there's Goliath's sword. And so apparently this sword took on something of a religious, sacred significance, much like the bronze serpent in the wilderness did. They would keep these things, and they would be sort of figureheads or symbols. Of course, whenever they became idols, they had to destroy them, like the bronze serpent, but they would keep them. And so the Goliath sword was a symbol that they held on to. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. The men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the entrance of the valley and the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell along the road to Shaarim as far as Gath and Ekron. And the children of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and they plundered their tents. And so they win in a rout. And they take all their stuff. And they are victorious. And then afterwards, Saul says, "Who is this guy? Tell me more about him." And Abner says, "I don't know. I've never met him. I don't know much about him." Abner, of course, was a leader of the army. And so Saul finds out, and Saul makes David the new leader of the army. We'll cover that in the coming weeks. So lessons here, there are a lot of them. I think some of them that are particularly highlighted, though, the fear and complacency on the part of the people. They didn't want to do it. They were shaking in their boots, in their tents, and they didn't want anybody else to do it either. And that's a sin problem that we always have to be on guard against. if we ourselves are not called to a task, that sometimes is fine. But we have to let the person who is called to the task do his job. And if we are called to the task, we ought to be courageous, confident, ambitious. Go for it if you're trusting in God. Some preachers I've heard, they push the story in an interesting way, but I think it's a little imbalanced. I've heard them say, you know, David is Jesus, and we're the people in the tents. And there's some truth to that when it comes to the work on the cross. You know, we are not the person who brings our salvation. But I still think we're called to imitate the best features of David, just like we're called to imitate Christ. And so we ought to be like David when it's our calling to be like David. When we're called to do a job, we should do it. We should trust in God, but we should be confident about it. We should go forward and fight because of our faith. And it's not because we think we're hot stuff, but because the battle is the Lord's. Having a robust confidence in God's providence should inspire us to get to work. Think of Stonewall Jackson on the battlefield, right? And I don't know if this was real or not, but in the movies, right, those things, the bullets are whizzing by his head, and he's just standing there, right, not moving. And they say, why aren't you afraid? and he says that I am as safe here as I am at home in my bed because of his commitment to the providence and sovereignty of God. And so Calvinism, rather than making us complacent and just saying, well, you know, whatever's going to happen is going to happen, it ought to make us invincible. We ought to go forward saying, God is going to keep his promises. He's going to use his people, and he will win the battle. And this story ought to motivate us to get to work, to be excited, to be confident, to be relying on the Lord to win the battle, not with the sword and the spear, but still to win the battle. And he's going to see us through. Well, we're out of time, so I better go ahead and wrap us up if you want to.
It's interesting. Jamie Soule says he's gotten a lot of criticism, particularly from mothers, because he teaches their little boys these gory battle scenes, cutting off heads, and the little boys like to sing.
Absolutely. You know, and this is something to be encouraged in raising boys, is you want them to have this sense of adventure and confidence. They have to be harnessed, of course, and directed, but they should have sticks and guns. There was a funny memory I have when I worked at the bookstore at RTS, and they had this little kids' table. And, you know, the little short little plastic chairs had the big fat cylinder legs. Well, he looked at that thing. And he kind of looked in every direction. He grabs it by the back. He flips it up to where those, you know, cylinders are pointing up. And he goes, so he had turned the chair into an anti-aircraft launcher. But there's just something in kids, in boys, to want to do that. And so, yeah, we don't want to discourage that. We want to own that and to direct that.
We don't want to be like used to seeing Fred in books about dragons. Actually confronted
with one. No, that's right. Didn't know what to do. So be encouraged, be motivated by this to go forth to fight the giants. Let's close in prayer. Dear God, we do thank you for the example of your servant David, for his confidence and boldness, but most of all for his faithfulness. We thank you for the knowledge that the battle belongs to you, that Jesus is our captain, and that he has given us the gifts of the Spirit to follow after him. Bless us that we would be bold, that we would be confident, that we would carry forth your name as a banner so that all the world would know that you are the living God, and that Jesus is our victorious King. We pray these things in his name. Amen.